library's 2027 budget. The Hibbing Historical Society Museum invites you to a holiday open house Friday, December 5th from 10 to 2. Enjoy refreshments, holiday music, games, and prizes. Lights in the Pines is a drive-through holiday light display at the Itasca County Fairgrounds in Grand Rapids, 5 to 8 p.m. Fridays and Saturdays, now until Christmas. After seeing the lights, you may park and explore North Pole Junction inside the fair's commercial building. Crosby has their community tree lighting Friday, December 5th at 5 p.m. in Marketplace Plaza. Enjoy hot chocolate and other goodies. After Dark is our late-night Saturday showcase of a variety of musical styles outside our normal KAXE mix. Tune in after Green Cheese at 9 p.m. to hear punk, hip-hop, electronic, metal-themed shows, and more. Northwood's Friends of the Arts and Cook presents It Starts With an Idea, a multimedia exhibit by Mary Lou Ellison, December 4th through the 27th. There's an opening reception Friday, December 5th from 5 to 7. Now back to Morning Edition here on KAXE KBXE.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Kremlin says Russian President Vladimir Putin accepted some proposals in a U.S.-backed peace plan for Ukraine, but he rejected others. NPR's Charles Maines reports.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov rejected the idea Russia had dismissed the U.S. peace plan outright, saying Putin's give and take over U.S. proposals was a normal part of the negotiating process. Peskov said Moscow remained open to future meetings to narrow differences, but that Russia preferred diplomacy out of the public eye. The comments came after a late-night marathon meeting between Putin and White House envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner at the Kremlin failed to reach a compromise. The Americans had sought Putin's support for a revised U.S. peace plan for Ukraine, one that included more input from Ukraine and Europe after an earlier draft was criticized as heavily weighted in Russia's favor. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says he authorized and watched an initial U.S. military strike on a boat in the Caribbean in September. He says he didn't watch a second round of a strike that killed two survivors. Some lawmakers say that may be a war crime. NPR has learned Hegseth had target engagement authority in the strikes and that he gave verbal or written authority for two strikes to kill and two strikes to sink the boat. The administration alleges the boats are smuggling drugs to the U.S. The suspect in last week's shooting of two National Guard members in Washington, D.C., has been formally charged. NPR's Juliana Kim has more.
Ramanullah Lakhanwal is facing felony charges, including first-degree murder for the killing of Army Specialist Sarah Beckstrom, as well as assault with the intent to kill for the shooting of Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf, who remains in serious condition. The suspect pleaded not guilty to both charges, according to one of his attorneys. He remains in the hospital due to injuries sustained after the shooting. The judge ordered the suspect held without bond. His next court hearing is scheduled for January 14th. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
The federal government shutdown held up funding for a program that offers financial help for heating to millions of people. Several states are now reopening their applications for the program. From member station WHYY, Sophia Schmidt reports on the latest one.
Pennsylvania opens its low-income home energy assistance program, or LIHEAP, today, a month later than usual. Justina Ray is a preschool teacher and mom of two who lives just north of Philadelphia. She says she's been waiting to turn on her heat until she can get a LIHEAP grant to pay her heating bill. She's relieved that the program is up and running.
Not only for my household, but just for so many families that depend on it, it definitely feels like a weight has been lifted.
Pennsylvania plans to start sending out its first LIHEAP payments in the coming weeks. For NPR News, I'm Sophia Schmidt in Philadelphia.
On Wall Street, in pre-market trading, Dow futures are higher. This is NPR. A Senate committee will hold a confirmation hearing today for President Trump's choice to lead NASA. The billionaire and private astronaut, Jared Isaacman, will answer questions. In prepared testimony, he says he wants to use commercial spaceflight to help the U.S. return to the moon before China does. And Isaacman wants to speed up U.S. investment in nuclear propulsion to help plan future NASA missions to Mars. The CEO of artificial intelligence company OpenAI has issued a, quote, code red to employees this week. Sam Altman is worried about Google's growing artificial intelligence capabilities. NPR's Bobby Allen reports Google's latest version of its Gemini AI chatbot has exceeded expectations.
In a memo sent to OpenAI staff confirmed by NPR, Altman said the company needs to hyper-focus on improving ChatGPT. And as a result, Altman told employees it is pushing back work on other products like AI agents for health and shopping and pausing a push into advertising. It comes as Google's latest Gemini chatbot beat out all the rival AI chatbots in a series of industry benchmark tests. It, for the first time, pulled Google ahead of the competition in the AI race. While ChatGPT remains the most popular chatbot, the company is confronting questions about its finances. And that's because Altman said the company is not turning a profit and isn't expecting to until 2030. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
The power company in Cuba's capital, Havana, says there's been a large outage on the island. The utility says several provinces on the western part of Cuba are in the dark. That includes Havana. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include BritBox, committed to helping viewers unbox the unexpected over the holidays with British TV, including original series Lindley and a new season of Karen Peary. Streaming at BritBox.com.
I found a song.
So I found KAXE when I was in college here in Bemidji. I actually can remember being at the stoplights at Dave's Pizza, just jumping radio stations, and it must have been, I want to say it was the Jayhawks, maybe Wilco was on the radio, and it floored me. I was like, wait, how am I hearing this in Bemidji, in northern Minnesota? I thought I had to be in the Twin Cities to get this stuff.
Mark is a member of KAXE. We are people powered. The music that you hear is not chosen by the government or an algorithm or a corporation. It's chosen by your friends and neighbors. Over 70 hours a week is produced by local volunteers. Support the people of northern Minnesota and KAXE with your donation now. Go to KAXE.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Special envoy Steve Witkoff smiled as he strolled through Moscow's Red Square yesterday. That was on his way in to talks between Russian and American officials over the war in Ukraine.
On the way out, it became clear the two sides did not break through to a peace agreement. They were working from a draft proposal amended by European and Ukrainian negotiators. Europeans had already rejected a plan skewed toward Russia. Coming up, we'll speak with former U.S. Ambassador to NATO Julianne Smith about the European perspective on all this.
We go now to NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, who's covering all this from Kyiv, Ukraine. Hey there, Eleanor.
Hello, Steve.
How was the meeting?
They lasted about 5 hours and started 3 hours late because they were waiting to meet President Vladimir Putin. And that's when Steve Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who was also in attendance, got their tour of Red Square. By the way, this is Witkoff's sixth visit to Moscow. He has not visited Ukraine. The talks broke up late last night with nothing concrete. Both sides called them constructive and productive. And this morning, the Kremlin says it's ready to sit down with the Americans as many times as necessary. Actually, the most telling comments came from President Putin himself, speaking separately to the media before the talks concluded. Let's listen. He accuses the Europeans of thwarting President Trump's attempts to bring peace in Ukraine. He says they amended the document knowing it would be unacceptable to Russia just so they could block the process and blame it on Moscow. Putin also made veiled threats to Europe, saying Russia didn't want war with Europe, but it was ready if Europe brought it on. And he said such a war wouldn't be, quote, like the surgical one that Russia's conducting in Ukraine. Well, yeah, European news outlets went wild over that comment. It was the main topic on primetime news.
Well, what are the Ukrainians saying?
Well, yesterday, President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke from Ireland. He's been bathing in European support over the last few days. He was in Paris before that. Zelensky has agreed in principle to this amended document. He didn't comment on the negotiations, but said Europe must keep the pressure on Russia. Here he is.
so that Russia does not believe it will be rewarded for this war with stolen Ukrainian land or thousands kidnapped Ukrainian children.
So, Steve, that's a far cry from the big business deals with Russia that President Trump has been talking about.
Where does this actually leave the effort for peace, Eleanor?
Well, Ukrainians never thought Putin would ever sign any deal. They say he doesn't want peace. He continues to bomb Ukraine and kill civilians on a near-nightly basis. And I spoke with Mykhailo Samus, director of a geopolitical research network in Ukraine. He says not only will Putin never stop, but Ukraine will never give away territory in the eastern Donbass region that the Russians are demanding. He says there is no possibility of a long-term peace document. Here he is.
All of these negotiations only about ceasefire on the front line. No withdrawing forces from Donbass, no recognizing that the Russian occupying forces will be legal on Ukrainian territory. Of course not.
I'd like to find out here, Eleanor, if there's a mistaken assumption. The president of the United States has assumed that Russia wants to stop the killing. He wants to, obviously they must. That leaked phone conversation by Bloomberg with Steve Witkoff contains in it an assumption that Russia wants to end this and the deal is obvious. That's the U.S. assumption. Has Russia shown it actually sees it that way?
No, Putin, the dying doesn't affect him. In fact, Zelensky and analysts confirm this, that in the month of October alone, 25,000 Russian soldiers died in Ukraine. That doesn't affect Putin. They hide it from the Russian public anyway. I think Secretary of State Marco Rubio's comments yesterday from Washington are the most telling. Rubio said the conflict in Ukraine is not our war, and President Trump has a million other things to focus on. Mm. So there you go.
And Paris Eleanor Beardsley, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Steve.
The war in Ukraine is top of the agenda at a meeting of NATO foreign ministers in Brussels today, but there will be a very notable absence, Secretary of State Marco Rubio. It's the first time the U.S. is not represented in more than 20 years. From Brussels, Terry Schultz reports on concerns about who is being left out of a U.S.-backed peace process for Ukraine.
No voice, no veto power. European diplomats are watching from the sidelines while the U.S. negotiates what happens at the front line.
There's this thinking in the administration about too many cooks in the kitchen, and so they wanted to keep the European cooks out.
Jim Townsend is a former Pentagon official with decades working on European and NATO policy. He's currently holding consultations in Europe with the Atlantic Council and International Affairs think tank.
It's been very painful to watch, knowing the European issues, knowing what's at stake for them, and knowing that they can be a part of the solution, too.
Still, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte had nothing but compliments for the process.
It was only the American president who was able to break that deadlock in the end, and he did. And therefore, these talks are now underway. We do not yet know whether they will be successful. We will try everything we can do to be as positively involved as possible.
Europeans have had some success, for example, in helping to rewrite the original 28-point peace plan presented by Washington into one less overwhelmingly favorable to Moscow. The new draft did not rule out eventual NATO and European Union membership for Kyiv, nor some kind of reassurance force provided by European militaries in Ukraine. But no one knows for sure what U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff presented to the Russians. With the Trump administration continually reminding Europe it will have the primary responsibility in supporting Ukraine, Swedish Defense Minister Paul Jonsson urges Washington to stay in close contact.
Nothing about the Europeans without the Europeans, and we, of course, are going to have a central role in the rebuilding of Ukraine as well. So the more we are involved, the better of a peace agreement we can achieve.
But Secretary of State Marco Rubio is skipping Wednesday's NATO ministerial meeting. It's the first time in decades a U.S. Secretary of State won't attend the regular meeting, which takes place just after Witkoff and President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner held talks in the Kremlin, and as Russian President Vladimir Putin blames Europe for preventing progress in the negotiations. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Ambassador Julianne Smith joins us. She served as the U.S. ambassador to NATO during the Biden administration and is now president of the consulting firm Clarion Strategies. Ambassador, good morning.
Good morning.
Does it matter that Marco Rubio doesn't show up at a NATO meeting?
I think it does matter that the U.S. Secretary of State is not present. It is common for the NATO alliance to accommodate often the schedule of the U.S. Secretary of State to ensure that he or she can be in attendance. You can send your deputy. It is certainly common. We've seen that with other countries. But to not have the U.S. at the table at this critical moment when the key topic of conversation is Ukraine is not going to be a welcome sign among our European allies.
Does it really mean the Europeans have been sidelined, even though they did get to change the peace proposal?
Well, look, Ukraine has always been a NATO project. Even before the war started, almost 4 years ago, the alliance was focused on preventing the war from starting. When it happened, every NATO meeting was focused on Ukraine. They are obviously concerned that they cannot get a direct readout from the United States on what happened in Moscow. The hope is that the Deputy Secretary of State, who will be there, Christopher Landau, will provide a readout. But what was common during the Biden administration was when we sent an official to Moscow, as we did in the months leading up to the start of the war, that official would then make a stop in Brussels on the way home to provide all of the information that the allies were seeking on what transpired in that engagement. So I suspect there are some disappointed European allies on the other side of the Atlantic today.
Judging by the public statements that we do have, how do you read the meeting in Moscow?
I did not find it encouraging. It feels like Groundhog Day. We have seen time and time again the Russians rejecting the ceasefire and the terms of some sort of negotiated settlement. We saw the Russians do this in the spring of this year. They had a 50-day deadline that came and went in July. And now, once again, in December, we are seeing a very cool reception by the Russians to this proposed peace plan. So it feels to me like we are not able to move the needle right now. And the middle ground that we so desperately need between Ukraine and Russia seems as far away as ever.
I asked Eleanor about what seemed to be a mistaken assumption, the assumption that Russia is worried about losing so many people. Eleanor reports they don't seem actually that worried. But that leads to a follow-up question. Can you imagine any leverage the United States could use to push the Russians toward a settlement?
Yes, I do believe that the United States could apply more pressure on Moscow to persuade President Putin to be far more open to negotiations and flexible in his negotiating position. I believe that the United States made a good start. The Trump administration made a good start by placing sanctions quite recently on Rosneft and Lukoil. I think more actions like that, with perhaps the delivery of Tomahawks to Ukraine, would capture Putin's attention and put him in a different mindset for these future negotiations. But right now, there is not an indication that the Trump administration is prepared or willing to apply that kind of pressure.
There have been some news reports about carrots offered. We can do business together if only you resolve this war. Does that make sense?
I think it makes sense from a Russian perspective. No doubt they are very interested in opening up their economic relationship with the entire world, particularly the United States. They've been very isolated on the world stage since the war started. But I think it's going to take more than incentives. I do believe the United States has the power to apply pressure and should apply that now that we've seen this very lukewarm response on the part of the Russians.
Julianne Smith was the U.S. ambassador to NATO during the Biden administration. Ambassador, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
are tuned in to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and in just a bit, I'll be joined by Heidi Holton. We'll be your Wednesday Morning Show hosts until 9 o'clock before we hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. Central Lakes College Jingle and Mingle event is Friday, December 5th, beginning at 5:30 at Roundhouse Brewery in Nisswa. Wear your favorite ugly sweater and listen to music from the Central Lakes Jazz Orchestra. Donations support CLC music student scholarships. The Crosty Arts Center in Grand Rapids has an online art and wreath auction now through December 5th. Wreaths may be viewed in person December 5th and 6th. Find more info and bid at mccrostyartscenter.org. The Bagley Community Theater presents A Christmas Carol December 4th through the 6th at 7 p.m., plus Sunday, December 7th at 2 p.m. at the Bagley High School Auditorium. Tickets available at Ace Hardware in Bagley or at the door. Great Tales Animal Rescue has Santa Paws, a chance to get your pet's photo taken with Santa on Saturday, December 6th from 10 to 2 at Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids. On the Rivers, our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music weekdays at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. Now back to Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Merrily We Roll Along, a new cinematic interpretation of the Stephen Sondheim musical, starring Jonathan Groff, Daniel Radcliffe, and Lindsay Mendez, in movie theaters starting December 5th. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Amy Martinez. In 1970, the Beatles broke up. Paul McCartney and his family left the chaos of Abbey Road for a quieter life on a farm in Scotland. But soon the itch came back. He wanted to get back to writing silly love songs.
And what's wrong with that? I'd like to know. 'Cause here I go.
Paul McCartney's new band was called Wings, and they became one of the biggest hit makers of the 1970s. McCartney chatted with us about his new book, Wings, the Story of a Band on the Run. And we started where the Beatles ended.
I didn't really see it coming. The sort of giveaway was that we weren't spending a lot of time with each other. Once we started to, you know, get girlfriends and wives, once John, for instance, hooked up with Yoko, that was, you know, telling. I could see that he now wanted to go in another direction. And I just hooked up with Linda. I didn't need to go in another direction. We could have just continued as we were. But things were changing. But at the time, it was quite a shock.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you were willing to, you know, keep giving this a try, it sounded like.
Yeah, sure. With the Beatles, it would have been great. I was trying to encourage us to sort of go back and sort of start from square one. But in actual fact, I did that with Wings. It was kind of a strange move, really, but the alternative was to have a big, what they would call the supergroup. I mean, looking back on it now and reading the Wings book, it was like, my God, I'm a maniac. I am a total maniac.
Tell me, though, post-Beatles, now you're on your farm, your sheep farm in Scotland, you're with Linda, the kids. Where were you creatively at that point?
I was in a simpler frame of mind. And I think I was in a freer state of mind. I remember thinking, when I was with the Beatles, we had our office in London, and at Christmas time, someone would buy me a Christmas tree. And then when I was up in Scotland, I thought, this is great. No one's going to buy me a Christmas tree. I've got to go and get my own. I mean, you know, something as simple as that. Yeah. Felt like total freedom. It was like, this is great. I love this.
So it sounds like the juices started to flow for sure.
Yeah, you know, it really was like a rebirth. And then the craziest thing was my lovely wife, Linda. We would sing around the house, and I always remember thinking, wow, she's really got something. but she's completely inexperienced.
I mean, did you have to pitch her to be in the band, or did she want to be?
No, she was very cute. She could tell I wanted to put a band together. I said, do you want to be in it? She sort of said, yeah.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live. You know you did. But if this ever changes, makes you give in and cry. Say, live and let die.
We had a lot of fun. Yeah. It was crazy. There were certainly moments that were fraught with danger and nervousness.
Oh, like what? Like what moments? Please tell me.
Oh, my God. We were playing crazy little gigs. I had a song that we used to do called Wildlife. The intro is on piano, so Linda had the intro. I used to say, we'd like to do a song now called Wildlife. One, two, three, one, two, three. Nothing. And I look over at Linda, and she's looking kind of, you know, perplexed. Oh, hell, how does this go? So I think, oh, okay, I'll show her. So I walk over, and I go, okay. And I've forgotten it. So... But bloody hell, the two of us. Well, luckily, the audience thought this was like a sort of gag. Is this rehearsed? And then suddenly it clicked in, and Linda remembered it, and she started it, and we did the song.
When Wings, you know, was touring British universities, playing covers, playing Wings songs, but no Beatles songs. I mean, it sounded like in the book that you really kind of rejected any of the doors that would open by you being a Beatle.
Well, you know, at the time I thought, I'm trying to make a new band here. I'm trying to do this new thing. You know, and promoters would say, would you just please just do Yesterday? We said, no, we're not doing it. We did it that way in order to build a Wings repertoire.
Yeah.
Once that happened, I was around about 76. When we had a record, Band on the Run, suddenly now we had songs that the audience would recognize that were our songs, Wings songs. So then I felt easier about, oh yeah, you know, here's a Beatles song. So now I interspersed them, but I felt I had to establish the identity of Wings first.
If I ever get out of here, thought of giving it all.
That's Sir Paul McCartney. His new book is Wings, the Story of a Band on the Run. Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been fun. And listen, NPR is great and must always survive and educate us all in the ways of life.
Perfect. Perfect way to end it. This is NPR News.
Midterms are less than a year away, and election officials across the country are already preparing for the possibility of interference by the Trump administration.
At this point, I think we're all just kind of used to, all right, what's the next crazy hairball thing that's going to pop up?
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. What election officials are watching for as midterms draw closer on All Things Considered from NPR News.
can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and it is a cold one out there. I was surprised how cold it was when I was wiping the snow off my car, and it looks like it's going to be like that all day today. It's going to be a partly sunny skies, the temperature dropping to 2 to 6 degrees this afternoon. Northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Wind chills as low as negative 15 today. Tonight, partly cloudy with lows around negative 9. West-northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Wind chills as low as negative 17. But luckily, Thursday, it's going to start warming up again. 20% chance of snow in the morning. Increasing clouds. Temp 16 to 21 degrees. South winds 5 to 15. Increased chance of snow in the evening with lows near 8 degrees. Then Friday, mostly cloudy with highs in the low 20s. And in a bit, I'll be joined by Heidi Holton, and in just a bit, we're also going to hear from National Native News. We've got quite the show planned for you this morning. We are going to have a review from our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski, talking about the new Cameron Crowe book, and then we're also going to be joined by some members of the Bemidji Downtown Alliance talking about a new thing they're doing this year. Well, actually, they did it last year, but they're continuing to do it this year for the holiday season. And also, I'm going to be talking with Mary Knox Johnson from Loon Country Arts, talking about their new location that opens today at the Carnegie Library here in Bemidji. Speaking of holiday shopping, I just want to warn you all that sometimes when you put something in the cart and you just want to check how much shipping is, sometimes you can accidentally buy the item by doing that. That happened to me. I was looking at a record and I was curious because on one website shipping was going to cost me $20. So I wanted to see what this other website would charge me for shipping. And then I accidentally bought the record. Now, I know a lot of you are probably thinking, Andrew, accidentally buying a record seems kind of fishy. And you know what? I'm not mad that I bought it. I was more shocked and surprised. But luckily, the shipping was under $18. So it all worked out. In a way, it was meant to be. And who am I to deny fate that way? And don't forget, we have our question of the week. We want to hear about the things you make or have made to give as gifts. Text 218-326-1234. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. And we receive support from Minnesota Power, an elite company powering the region's homes, businesses, and industries since 1923. Learn more about its vision of a carbon-free future at mnpower.com/energyforward. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. If you visited Southeast Alaska's Totem Heritage Center this fall, you may have noticed something missing from one of its outside walls. That's because three carved posts, which were made by students and master carvers, were temporarily removed for restoration work. As KRBD's Hunter Morrison reports, the house posts were reinstalled in November.
Inside a workshop at Ketchikan's National Guard Armory, Tlingit Master Carver Tommy Joseph is hard at work. He's slowly shaving a block of wood into the shape of a dorsal fin with an oddly shaped knife.
And the tool that you're using, does that have a particular name or...?
Charlie.
He then trades Charlie, the reverse bent knife, for a tool that looks like a sickle but works like a hammer. Large wood shavings fall to the floor. The new dorsal fin will later be affixed to the Heritage Center's killer whale house post, which is like a small totem pole. It's a small piece of a larger project to restore three of the museum's house posts. Historically, house posts are carved to honor events, clans, or tribes. Joseph says they were cracked on the outside due to decades of wear.
It's time to take care of them, treat them a bit, and clean them, then treat them, and hopefully give them lots and lots of life in the future here.
The three posts were carved in the mid-1980s as part of the Heritage Center's Native Art Studies program. Students worked for 6 months alongside indigenous master carvers to create 5 posts for the museum's exterior. But like totem poles, house posts traditionally aren't restored. They're meant to last the lifespan of a person, about 80 years, then returned to the earth for decomposition. But these house posts have only been around for about half of that time, and museum staff say they still have life in them.
They tell the story of the Totem Heritage Center in a way that is not just about the totem poles inside of it.
That's museum director Samantha Forsco, who says the house posts document the museum's history and relationships between students and instructors.
This is one of a handful of totem restoration projects Joseph has been a part of in Southeast Alaska. He says each one is different from the last. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Hunter Morrison.
It's not every day you get to see an eagle, let alone two together, alive and up close. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, it's something visitors of a Phoenix, Arizona nonprofit recently did while blessing these animals during a Native American wildlife celebration.
Robert Mesta with Liberty Wildlife is Pasquayaki and honors Eagle Cisco and Anasazi with a song.
And they're revered for their strength, their intelligence, and even their healing and protective powers.
Things the Phoenix nonprofit is helping guests tap into one November Sunday morning.
Pinch some sacred tobacco, take it to the eagle, and say their prayer. And oftentimes the eagles will flap their wings. To feel the wind of the eagle is like the ultimate experience.
That lasted for an hour. Augie Molina, who is Pasquayaki, spiritually prepared people bringing offerings to the birds.
When you smudge, it's going to take as long as it's going to take.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohanic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle. In just a bit, we're going to hear more from Morning Edition talking about the story of wooden nesting dolls is not just Russian. It's also Chinese. They'll be coming up. And also, some people spend their retirement traveling or playing golf, but the volunteers with Philadelphia's Senior Environment Corps see themselves as watchdogs for the local environment. That'll be coming up in just a moment. Looking at some live music going on today. We got Morning Bird Trio at Smoke on the Water in Coleraine at 5 p.m. today, and Cedric Burnside at the West Theater in Duluth at 7:30 p.m. That's going on tonight on this cold Wednesday. We received support from Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, saunas, and more. Learn more online at hottubsmn.com. And we receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. And KXE News is working on a story explaining the complex workings behind your property taxes, but we need your help. Share property tax statements and questions by email news@kaxe.org. These real-world examples will help everyone better understand how and why you may be seeing your taxes rise. The news team will contact you, and your information will remain confidential. Now we're going to hear more from Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. When you think of things that are quintessentially Russian, you might think of those painted wooden nesting dolls stacked one inside of the other. NPR's John Ruwich visited the place where most of the world's stacking dolls are made, and he found something quintessential.
The train to this small town zips by rolling hills and butterscotch fields of ripe corn. And when it slows to a stop, we're about 125 miles from the border between Russia and China. But not on the Russian side.
女士们、先生们，一面
This is Yi Mianpo in China's northeastern Heilongjiang province. Stacking dolls are important here. There are silhouette statues of them at a major road junction and bright paintings of them on some of the town walls. There have been estimates in Chinese state media that some 90% of the world's stacking dolls are produced here in Yi Mianpo. Wang Haishan runs one of the biggest companies that makes them here in town. He shows us a small workshop where, he explains, the unfinished dolls are created. It starts with a lindenwood log, about 4 inches thick and 18 inches long, stripped of its bark. It's hammered onto a lathe. A man in a backwards ball cap and mask hollows it out with long metal chisels that look like bladed fireplace pokers. Then he wields a gouge to form the doll's squat, bowling pin-like shape. Each doll is a little smaller than the one before it, so they can stack up one inside the other. Some sets have 6, others have 10 or even more. You can tell they produce a lot. The floor, workbenches, and windowsills are covered in wood shavings. Wang got his start on a lathe after middle school. He worked his way along the assembly line, then opened his own company to make stacking dolls, or tao wa, as they're called in Chinese. Matryoshka is the Russian term, and the first ones were made in Russia in the late 1800s. At that time, the Russian Empire was at its peak, Tolstoy and Chekhov in their prime. The government was building rail lines to expand the empire eastward. They cut through Manchuria, and Yi Mianpo was a stop along the line. Matryoshka followed. When the carving is done, the blank wooden forms are sent down the road to one of Wang's paint shops. A lone woman listens to a radio program on her phone as she dabs green paint on dolls. Traditional nesting dolls often bear images of Russian peasant women, babushkas, with ruddy cheeks and headscarves. Wang Xiaohar shows one with a Russian-looking castle on it. Others elsewhere are painted with pandas or historical figures like Stalin and Mao. Presumably, there's a market. As for the work, it's pretty flexible, with people coming in from neighboring villages. Wang Xiaohar says it allows her to earn some money while looking after her child, who goes to school here in town. Most of her co-workers are out for the day, harvesting crops. This is a hardscrabble part of China, where the government has struggled for years to revitalize the economy. Millions of people have left for greener pastures. But company owner Wang Haishan and his compatriots churning out Russian stacking dolls here in Yi Mianpo seem to have figured out a way to make things work. Wang says his company has been growing. And he shows us a made-in-Russia nesting doll that he bought as a sample to learn from. Thing is, he says his nesting dolls are more intricate, and they're cheaper. John Ruich, NPR News, Yi Mianpo, China.
In this country, some people spend their retirement playing golf. Other people travel. WHYY's Sophia Schmidt reports on how some retirees in Philadelphia spend their time.
Bob Meyer is 71 years old. He retired from a career as a biology professor, but he still likes to keep busy.
The horrible lure of retirement is to do nothing. And, you know, that's no good because you just end up vegetating at home watching, you know, daytime TV, and I don't want to do that.
Instead, Meyer volunteers with the Senior Environment Corps in Northwest Philadelphia. The group of more than a dozen retirees take on projects like sampling the soil and testing the area's waterways for pollution. Today, Meyer is in a lab at a local college. He's looking through a microscope, counting tiny pieces of plastic, or microplastics, from a sample of creek water.
Okay, I got a pretty sharp view now.
He finds tiny pieces with jagged edges and thin plastic fibers.
Ah, got a thread, and it's pink, so I know it's plastic.
Altogether, Meyer finds dozens of pieces of microplastics in this one small sample of creek water.
I don't know how you get it out. I know how you stop it. You stop using plastic. But that's... we'll be pushing up the daisies before that stops.
It's not all counting plastics in the lab. Some volunteers wade into streams to collect water samples. Others teach kids how to identify aquatic critters. Meyer and fellow volunteer David Schogel say the group is always looking for new members to join.
Anything you're particularly looking for in people who join?
If they're breathing, we want them.
Schogel is 85 and a retired social worker. He sees the nearly three decades he's volunteered with the Senior Environment Corps as part of his legacy.
I'm not a wealthy fellow, and I don't have any money to leave behind to any groups or even my family, but I can leave a better world.
The group meets monthly at a senior center. That's where 74-year-old Eleanor Lundy Wade found out about it. She's a former health inspector and public health educator.
I said, there's seniors that love and do the environment. I said, I want to be one of them.
Fred Lewis helped found the group more than 30 years ago. At 98, he's the oldest member. He says the Corps has been testing water quality for years, but looking for microplastics is new. Lewis is old enough to remember back when plastic first became widely used.
I mean, it was something that was so new that people were just trying to get suggestions as how we can take advantage of it. And now it's how we can end it.
Lewis says some people might assume that the older you get, the less involved with society you become. But he hopes this group changes some minds.
At the count of three.
At the end of every meeting, the volunteers close by singing the Senior Environment Corps song. For NPR News, I'm Sophia Schmidt in Philadelphia.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Amy Martinez.
Trust, Lord.
And that was Lady Ray from her new album Cover Girl. That song was called Best for Us. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Heidi Holtum.
Morning, Andrew.
Morning.
You're not a kidding on the cold weather, huh?
Yeah, it is cold out there.
Little blowy on Highway 2 off and on, where it was like all of a sudden you just needed to go down to 40 miles an hour
because
couldn't see in front of you. But, you know, you just take it easy, right?
Yeah. So today's going to be partly sunny. The temperatures are going to drop to 2 to 6 degrees this afternoon. And then northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Wind chills can feel as low as negative 15. Tonight, partly cloudy with lows around negative 9.
All right. I have a bone to pick with you, or a bone that came in through text yesterday.
Is it about wind chill?
No, that's that too, though. I'm like practically afraid to say wind chill now because of John Latimer's hatred of wind chill, that it doesn't mean anything. But anyway, that's a separate story.
It's not the first person I've heard say that.
No, it's using... So a guy texted in about, you know, when we get cold temperatures, that it is, he thought it was wrong to say negative, like negative 5 degrees. I usually say below zero, like five below, but some people say minus five, some people say negative. And he said it's not actually negative.
Okay.
So I'll take a look at the text again and get that out there for you. But when he said that yesterday, I was thinking, well, I've never heard anybody say negative. And then I was listening to you as I came in. I'm like, oh, Andrew says negative.
Yeah, I say negative.
Because it's not a negative number. That would mean, well, I'll find.
That would mean it was actually getting warmer?
Because there was someone that chimed in also, so there were actually two texts about this.
In support of not saying negative?
Yes, so you may have to change your ways. okay, so it was Tim from Maple Grove yesterday. Are you ready for it?
Yep.
When traditional winter temperatures are reported, people will say it's negative 8 degrees, for example. They could have said 8 below or minus 8. It seems to me negative 8 is not accurate. The temperature didn't change dramatically from normal to hostily negative when it was from 0 degrees Fahrenheit to 1 below 0. It is a substantial change from 1 to 0 degrees Celsius. Water changes state from solid to liquid at 0 degrees Celsius. My point is that weather reporting should not say that we have negative temperatures when reporting in Fahrenheit. Below zero or minus are accurate, but not negative. That seems to assign a subjective evaluation to the temperature. Did you know you were doing that?
I'm not entirely convinced.
All right. And then we also heard, after hearing from Tim, Dan in Minneapolis texted in and said, that was an elegant explanation for below zero versus negative temperatures. I concur, saying negative when describing temperatures below zero is incorrect. TV weather anchors should be ashamed for saying negative, and are probably the reason it's become so widely used. While we're at it, O's are not a substitute for zeros. Phone numbers don't use letters. Thanks, all. Let it snow.
Well, I was a weatherman at one point in my life, so
that's where it's coming from.
Yeah, you know, that's what. The more drastic, the more viewers you get. You know,
I guess. And from the look on your face, it doesn't look like you're considering changing your ways.
No, I'm not entirely convinced.
All right, I think other people are going to weigh in this morning. You can text 218-326-1234, and I thought it would be fun. So we get to later today put together our new podcast, the Season Watch.
That's true.
Pod, and this might be part of that, kind of the language of winter and looking out for things in winter, and should be a lot of fun.
Move over, Dan Fogelberg. You sang about the language of love. We are going to be singing about the language of temperatures.
Thanks for bringing up Dan Fogelberg. That's nice. We also want to hear from you today. Question of the week. We want to hear about the things that you make or have made to give as gifts. And the number to text is 218-326-1234.
And coming up later in the show, we're going to be hearing from our very own staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski, talking actually doing a review of a book from the new Cameron Crowe book, The Uncool, I believe it is called. And I'm excited to hear about it because I Tammy mentioned to me months ago that Cameron Crowe had wrote a book, and I was curious what it's actually about, you know, because he's got the career working for Rolling Stone. He's got the career making movies. So lots to pick from there.
I'm just taking a look here at some of his movies. I guess I didn't realize all of the ones he had done.
But I bet I can name all of them.
You think so?
Maybe.
All right.
Say Anything. And then, oh boy, after that. There's one before Jerry Maguire, but I can't think of what it is in between Jerry Maguire and...
It's one when it was a big one for me, the soundtrack.
Singles.
Yes.
And then after that, oh, geez, it would be... I Know We Bought a Zoo, Elizabethtown, Almost Famous. Aloha.
Yeah.
What am I missing? What am I missing?
There's a couple of music ones in here. A
couple of music ones.
He did the Pearl Jam 20 movie.
Oh, documentaries. I wasn't counting documentaries. Oh, okay.
And the Tom Petty one.
Okay. But I got all the major ones.
I think you missed one.
Oh, what is it?
Roadies.
Oh, that's a TV show.
Oh, okay. All right.
So I got all the movies. Look at me.
I didn't know he was a writer of Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yeah, he wrote the book. He wrote a book first, which is very hard to get. Don't try to buy one.
Okay.
Just kidding. You should try. It'll just be expensive.
And don't put it in your cart because you might accidentally buy it.
Yeah, you might accidentally buy it.
Yeah.
And that ain't cheap.
No. You got to watch the shipping and all of that stuff.
Well, how do you check for shipping?
No, that's what I do too. And I've made some real boneheaded moves in terms of, like, sometimes I bought something once from a nameless place that usually you can easily return things. But it was like a second party thing.
Oh.
And it was something that was way too hard to ship back. And I'm just speaking so vaguely here right now. It was cushions for deck chairs.
Oh.
Which I didn't really realize are very expensive.
Really?
Yeah.
And I can see that because they got to be durable outside.
Yeah. And I questioned buying them. And so I thought, maybe I'm going to send these back. And they're big. They're really big cushions. And... not only could I not send them back, but I was going to send them back, it was going to actually end up costing me more to mail them back.
Oh, geez.
Shipping wise. And so, yeah, it was not a good thing, but I ended up, I can tell you off air what ended up happening. I still feel a little guilty about it. I kind of put up a stink.
One time I bought something for a website and then it was like through another party fulfilled the order. And they sent me the wrong record, and I complained about it. And they're like, well, you can ship it back. And then I'm like, I don't want to do that.
Okay.
So I just kept it.
I know. Sometimes. We just heard back from, or we heard from Brandon Chase. He's correcting you here, Andrew. Can you take it? He said, as long as we're on the subject of correctness, it would be had written a book, not had wrote a book. Thank you, Brandon. He must have been like the grammar police spelling bee guy when he was growing up, I have a feeling. He knows.
Had written? Is that the correct way?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. we'd love to hear from you this morning. You can text us at 218-326-1234. Yeah, a couple of the movies, the Cameron Crowe movies, were right in my college years. So have just like... had a huge impact on me, but I haven't rewatched them, so this is going to be interesting to see.
I recently rewatched Jerry Maguire, and that's a great movie.
It is, yeah.
I also watched Elizabethtown recently. Not a great movie.
No, I actually walked out of that.
Oh my gosh.
There's like two movies, Desperately Seeking Susan and Elizabethtown.
Why'd you hate Desperately Seeking Susan?
Isn't
that the Madonna movie?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I thought that was a good movie.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you on that.
I've never walked out of a movie. The closest I've been was for this movie called 10,000 BC, which came out in like 2007 or 8.
Okay.
But that was the only close one.
I'm telling you, my giant crush on John Cusack and the boombox and Peter Gabriel song. Whew. Even though the storyline's a little like when I have watched it again. I mean, it's been 20 some years since I've seen it, but... storyline's a little weak. And like her dad in prison and like this whole thing. It's just a little.
And what does
lot.
He want to become? He wants to become like a fighting champion of some kind.
Yeah, he's like a.